people avoid talking about it, so I think that's why we should talk about it today. My name is Carol Berkland. I am the Secretary for the Middle East and East Africa of the Division for Global Mission of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in Chicago. And the title of today's presentation is Criticism of Israel, Is It Anti-Semitic? Well, Christians and certainly Lutherans have difficulty with this subject, and not without good reason. Certainly, we know about the statements that Martin Luther made, which are pretty much an embarrassment to us today in the light of the Holocaust. Whether you want to call Martin Luther anti-Semitic or not, I don't know, but certainly his statements were then used by the Nazi regime to, in a sense, validate their position. I think when I was doing the research for this presentation, I was so amazed to find people who had written certain things, or philosophers, scientists, whatever, who you really, in a sense, could not label as anti-Semitic because they didn't really focus their ideas within the context of Jewish anti-Semitism. But what happened as a result of what they had written or what they had said, anti-Semitic people simply took what they had written and used to very good advantage. It's an interesting thing to think about in terms of how one is responsible for what one writes. You can see the same thing now in the Salman Rushdie affair, where certainly Rushdie knew in what he was writing that it would cause a great deal of controversy, and probably knowing the Islamic community should have known that there would be riots and probably people killed. But it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of the freedom to express oneself and then the responsibility that goes along with that freedom.
Isn't it also the case, though, that when you grow up in a society where it is, in essence, anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. that as an individual, it's very difficult not to have some of the things that you say and some of your actions, whether they be individual or related to some group, be directed by society in a certain way? I mean, we could certainly look at you know, racism in our own country, or
exactly. That's the thing that I think we should realize from the beginning. A lot of people want to talk about this, the rise of the Nazis and the Holocaust and the whole issue of anti-Semitism in this century, as being somewhat of an aberration, a kind of historical accident. My contention is that it's not a historical accident. It's not an aberration. It simply reflected a view that was shared by most people at that time. And I want to go back and kind of explain how that happened and how that came about. And also the sense that it was a particularly German thing, I have some hesitancy with that too, because I think after we're finished talking today, you'll all recognize that anti-Semitism is not a thing that is particular to anyone's nationality, that if one puts together the right circumstances or the right historical circumstances, certainly this kind of thing can happen anywhere, and that's probably the lesson for us, that it is not simply a German phenomenon.
What were some of the comments that Martin Luther, I guess I'm not familiar with that.
Well, Luther was, again, I'm not a Luther scholar, but from what I've heard, Luther was very upset about the Jews in the sense that they did not recognize Jesus Christ as the Messiah. And he felt, certainly toward the end of his life, I think these writings, if anyone knows more about it, here, help me out. But I think his writings toward the end of his life were very virulent against the Jews, that their houses should be burned, this or that. He didn't say they should be killed, but Luther, in a sense, never forgave them for the fact that they did not recognize Jesus Christ as the Messiah. If anyone else wants to add anything to that, they can. But I think generally, that's what I've heard. But the Nazi regime took those statements and used them with great effect during the Second World War period. Anyway, I think also because of this particular history that Christians have, but Lutherans have especially, gives us a sense of guilt and also a sense of pause in discussing Israel. We're afraid of it. We're afraid of anti-Semitism. We realize now what the results of it can be, and we are hesitant to discuss Israel and certainly criticize Israel because it's very painful to be called anti-Semitic. I've experienced that myself. So what I hope to do today is, by the end of this period, we have some idea of what I would call the difference between anti-Semitic statements and what I also would call legitimate criticism of actions of the state of Israel. Both exist, certainly. I think another reason that we don't like to discuss anti-Semitism is because it is really a manifestation of what I call, and other people certainly call, radical evil. Sin and evil are not particularly popular things in our feel-good culture. And for that reason alone, I think we have to delve into this subject to realize that the evil one and the dark side of the soul and all these other nasty things that we don't like to admit do, in fact, exist. And that, as I said before, this is not simply an aberration, something that happened once in history and will go away, so to speak, because we've all turned into such nice people. There are really two types of anti-Semitism, one that I call Christian anti-Semitism and the other that I call nationalist racist anti-Semitism. And I'll talk about the Christian form first, briefly. What distinguishes Christian anti-Semitism from the nationalist racist variety was that there was always a limit in terms of Christian anti-Semitism. By limit, I mean there was always potentially grace for the Jew. There was a chance for the Jew to redeem himself or herself. It was simple. I mean, the Jews could simply say they were wrong. They could convert to Christianity. And in that sense, they would be let off the hook. I'm using a book that I, if anyone's interested in the whole history of the rise of Zionism and the Jewish state, this book, The Siege, by Connor Cruz O'Brien, is excellent, and he has a good section in here about Christian anti-Semitism and nationalist anti-Semitism as well. He says that there were two main currents in Western anti-Semitism in that period meaning just before the turn of the century, 1860, 1870. The two currents are Christian resentment and nationalist resentment. Christian resentment drew its strength from the centuries of Christian teaching, as strong in the Lutheran tradition as in the Catholic, which portrayed the Jews as a people uniquely set apart and accursed, the people chosen by God, who had then rejected and crucified his son. May the blood be on our children. You know, that whole business at the crucifixion of Jesus. Beyond that, Christians also blamed the Jews for the ideas that came at the period we call the Enlightenment, which was at a period where a lot of kind of sacred ideas were challenged in terms of science, in terms of religion, all that kind of thing. And the Jews have always been historically known for their liberal ideas, for their democratic ideas, for their ethical ideas. And the Christians also blamed the Jews at that point for these ideas, which really, in a sense, weakened Christian faith and Christian power. Because at that point, of course, Christian power and the church were very much associated with governments. The church and the government, in many cases, were almost one. And when you challenged the government, then you, at the same time, challenged the church. Christian anti-Semitism throughout the centuries had always recognized a limit in the Easter, for example, in the Easter liturgies of the Roman Catholic Church, a canon of the Easter Mass, you find this: O God, who in thy goodness dost not even deny mercy to the perfidious Jews. So you see that here in the canon of the Catholic Church, even though the Jews were guilty for crucifying and killing Christ, there still was mercy for them. So that's what I mean when I talk about a Christian limit. And in a sense, Christianity also needed the Jews as kind of an example of what happens to you when you don't accept Jesus Christ as the Messiah. They were kind of held up as an example of what happens to people who reject Christ. And then, of course, the Christian church saw itself as the replacement for the Jews. The Jews had their chance. They missed it. So we are the new Jerusalem, and the Jews are just, they're just not important, unnecessary. Forget it. Forget the Old Testament. Forget the Jews. And that's the replacement theory. Now, the nationalist, racist form of anti-Semitism was much more dangerous because, as I hoped to show, it was through the nationalist, racist form that this limit was ended, and therefore the Jews were fair game for genocide. Anti-Semitism, certainly at this period of time, was, as I said before, something accepted by a wide percentage of the population. It was just anti-Semitism was something that existed, and nobody thought too much about it. Nobody was particularly guilty about it. It just was a part of the way people thought at that time. Why was that the case? Well, there were a number of social reasons. Foremost among them probably was that by about 1871, the Jews in Western Europe had been totally emancipated, in a sense, by these, as a result of the Enlightenment, as a result of a lot of these liberal ideas that talked about democracy and revolution and what have you. And the Jews had really taken advantage of that after suffering through the years of the diaspora. And they distinguished themselves certainly in the professions, in business, in finance, in journalism. They became very visible, and they were very successful in what they set out to do. Again, the ideas of the Enlightenment had challenged the church and certainly had challenged undemocratic political structures. The ideas, a lot of people associated Jews with the ideas of the Enlightenment, which challenged the establishment government and the establishment church. Then you add to that a real social revolution, which was the Industrial Revolution. That sounds like a revolution that deals with only work, but it had great social ramifications as well. Up until this time, the mass of workers took pride in the work that they had done. That meant that they were very close to what they produced. If you were a tailor, you made a suit. If you were a carpenter, a tradesman, a craftsman, you had a very close relationship with the fruit of your work. During the Industrial Revolution, that was taken away from you because the work that you had done started to be done by machines. There's a very interesting description of this phenomenon in a book called Jews, God, and History by Max Demont, and I want to read a little bit to you because it describes this phenomenon very well. By 1800, capitalism and colonialism were in full flowering. Another development also had taken place, the Industrial Revolution. It is a little difficult to realize today that the Industrial Revolution is barely 100 years old. It is also a little difficult to realize that in 1850, the average industrial enterprise employed fewer than 50 people. With the growth of industrialism, intimate personal relationships between worker and owner disappeared. Foremen and department managers now stood between them. Absentee management appeared. The multiple plant developed. Employees became estranged from each other. 5,000 workers in a plant became a lonely crowd. And they talk about the economic, or Dumont talks about the economic ramifications of this. As a result, a lot of people who had considered themselves to be part of the prosperous middle class all of a sudden found themselves, as I said, replaced by machines. And instead of producing something, they produced services. And they were paid less for that. There were also some economic hardships, depressions at that period of time. Let's see, he talks about, it's very interesting, this new and ever-growing social class is composed of bureaucrats, bookkeepers, hack writers, petty academicians, marginal advertising, publicity, and professional men, small functionaries, lower echelon office workers, and others whose feet are in the parlor of the worker and whose heads are in the living room of the manager. They call these people, he calls them the white, the frayed white-collar class, which is a very interesting way of talking about it. These people were white-collar workers, and all of a sudden, their collars started to fray a little bit. They became less. They saw their standard of living go down. They saw their position in society go down, and of course, they didn't like it one bit. We shall also refer to this group as the frayed white-collar class in contrast to the white-collar class of professional and managerial people. It is among the insecure in this declassed, frayed white-collar group that we find most of the potential adherents of modern anti-Semitism. It is from this group that Hitler recruited his most ardent followers. Again, he says, this was the beginning of anti-Semitism. It was not a political movement, as someone once remarked, but a political weapon. Existing anti-Jewish feeling left over from the Middle Ages was slowly transformed into anti-Semitism by its constant application to this new use. The religious politician in the Middle Ages had asked for the banishment of the Jews so that they would not infect the Christian believer with doubt. The secular politician of the modern age did not ask for the banishment of the Jews because it would not have served his purpose. If the Jews were banished, the D-class, this lower, this white, frayed white-collar class, would immediately see that their condition had in no way improved. The way the first manipulation of anti-Semitism saw it, the Jews had to be kept around as perpetual scapegoats. What they, the politicians, did not foresee was the emergence of a new breed of totalitarian politician who would advocate the actual extermination of the Jews. They had not seen that their own irresponsible propaganda would be seized by neurotics and sadists and shaped into a philosophy of murder. I jumped a little bit ahead of myself there, but this frayed white-collar class that was so preyed upon by Hitler and other anti-Semitic politicians were very insecure. They were threatened. A lot of the kinds of systems, structures in society that they had come to trust, all of a sudden were pulled out from underneath them, and they were frightened. I mean, you can see that kind of thing happening. It happens in a number of places. It's happening certainly in this country today, and those people are always very easy political prey because they can be easily swayed, their fears can be manipulated, and that's exactly what happened next. Politicians saw this group, again, politicians who were not particularly anti-Semitic, but were not very, they were not very visionary. They only saw the advantage of using this group for their own political ends. It's a classic situation of the ends justify any means. So both these this frayed white collar class was used both by conservative and liberal politicians. The conservatives said, look to these frightened people. Look, it's the Jews. They're the ones who've got the socialist values, the communistic values. They want to make your life even worse than it already is. They want communism, and then, you know, whatever bit of status you have left in society is going to be wiped out in the communist revolution. On the other hand, the liberal politicians said, look at these Jews. They're taking your place. They are aggressive. They are the money grubbers. They're all of those other stereotypes that we all have heard. So in a sense, the Jews couldn't win. They absolutely couldn't win. They were a minority. They were set aside as a scapegoat for everything that had happened wrong in that period in society, in history. But again, there's let's see, there, yeah, here's an excellent description of what the politicians did. The politicians began to pander to this group because they needed the power that this group contained. Economic depressions were forcing the frayed white-collar class into the ranks of the working class, who they despised. They didn't want to go down there with those people. They were also fearful of the new philosophies of socialism and communism, which would give power to the same working class they despised. Politicians from both the right and the left used this group and the Jews to their own advantage. The Jew was held up to the frayed white-collar class as both the exploiting capitalist, the amoral banker, etc., or as the plotting communist, and communism was feared. If it were not for the Jew, the politician said, every frayed white-collar class person would be an important pillar in society. It's because of these people that you have this problem. Therefore, the Jews had to be kept around as potential scapegoats, but things got out of hand. What these politicians did not foresee, again, was this new type of totalitarian politician ruler who would then move this agenda on to its logical conclusion, which is you got to get rid of these people, and the way you get rid of them is you kill them. They could not foresee that their irresponsible propaganda would be seized upon by neurotics and sadists and, as I said, shaped into a philosophy for mass murder.
Excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Aren't some of those elements present still today then? I mean, as you look at economic forecasts and government reports, I mean, the gap between the rich and the poor is growing, and there's a lot of people who are feeling in the middle that they're being squeezed, and you see groups, rightist groups forming, and you know, mm-hmm. at least on the West Coast here, there's been the last couple of years, a couple different times where there's been big publicity kind of things done against the Jews and things like that.
I think it's, we don't have to be too worried about the, well, we have to be worried about the people who are getting squeezed, because they are, again, the mass that can be manipulated, and when that mass gets larger, I mean, right now most of us are well off, we have mortgages, our kids are in school, everything's going pretty well, but the time I think when we have to be very, very careful are times when there are two circumstances present. Number one, periods of great national humiliation, and number two, periods of great across-the-board economic disaster, meaning depression. As long as the majority of people are all right, we're not in so much danger. I mean, I'm not saying that that's a good situation when you have a tremendous gap between the rich and the poor, but if, let's say, there were a depression, if the deficit just got totally out of control, and the Japanese and the Germans who are funding our national debt, who are really paying for our national debt, were to pull out their investment in this country, and the dollar collapsed, and there was total economic chaos, then you have to start to worry and be very concerned. And the first thing you must do at that point, I think, is protect your minorities. And those people are the Jews and the homosexuals and the Southeast Asian refugees and the Latin American refugees, people who don't speak English, because those people are then just sitting there
blacks.
Waiting. And blacks, of course, blacks, are just waiting to be used to buy unscrupulous politicians to say, well, these people are the reason that you're in such a terrible situation. All that welfare you're paying to those blacks, that's what did it. You see? So yes, in that sense, I feel that this presentation today certainly has more applications than simply a historical situation. Yeah.
And in follow up what he said, that I believe it was the PI of the Times just last week or a week before had that chart in Seattle, for those of us that are this part of the mm-hmm. country, on the huge difference between the rich and the poor in this country, and it has shifted greatly and the emotional issue of who owns those factories that we work in, and so on. These are very large changes that are not potential, they're actual.
Again, it's another kind of industrial revolution in the sense that robots are now replacing people who used to work in factories. Yeah.
I also see, in terms of politics, a scapegoating going on. If you remember the last presidential election, just the mere mention that one of the presidential candidates belonged to the American Civil Liberties Union probably helped cause that first election. And that right now, it's not the Jews, but it's the liberals who are being scapegoated. And anybody who invites the tag liberal is looked on with almost political disgust now, because those people are opposing the ideas of the former administration, which created this widening gap between the rich and the poor, and somehow was able to do it by making the majority feel good about it, because the majority went through the Reagan years feeling good about allowing this whole situation to continue with the poor becoming poorer and more split families and not addressing that issue while suggesting we should spend billions of dollars on Star Wars. And somehow people bought all that from this man, because he couched it in the same kind of terms you're just talking about. And I think the fear that more political leaders like that will come on the scene in the future is not a minor concern. I think it's a major concern, because I see it as a real major concern in the next years.
The danger that I see is when this group of people who've been taught to feel good and expect that things will get better and better, when and if the time comes for this country to reap the reality of these irresponsible economic policies, like this incredible national debt, it will be not the poor people, you see, because they're used to it. They've lived in poverty for a number of years, but it's going to be the people like us who only expected that life would get better, and all of a sudden, if the economic bottle or the economic balloon bursts, then we are going to be the people who are going to be much more easily manipulated than the people who have been poor, because we're not accustomed to it. And that's in that sense, we are potentially the most dangerous.
And I also think this whole flag worshiping thing fits right into that, where you certainly wouldn't criticize the government for what happened, because that's anti-American. Don't you love this country? So there must be some other group responsible, and that's when the scapegoat comes in.
I was going to read this at the end, but that's the thing that's nice about Holden, is that you can start talking and then you move things around, and sometimes your lectures get a little disorganized, but anyway, I hope we learned something. Connor Cruz O'Brien, again the man who wrote this book, in the recent issue of the New York Review of Books, wrote a wonderful article about this terrible religious nationalist convergence, and he says, I think it's very interesting for us. He says, in conclusion, I would like to stress that all of us who are concerned with the potential for hatred in our societies should keep a wary eye on nationalism, and in particular, be watchful for signs of increasing hubris in nationalism anywhere. Some of us think we have seen a few such signs in American nationalism during the past decade, and most conspicuously during the recent political or presidential election campaign. Like many others, I did not at all like the combination in that campaign of strident displays of nationalism in the so-called issue of the pledge to the flag, and with the subliminal appeals to racist feelings, the Willie Horton case. That combination of nationalism and racism has a little taste of the old heady, he calls Volkisch cocktail, which is the situation in Germany where the state became God. Everything, the church, all these symbols came to be something that you worshipped. Please don't mistake my intention here. I'm not trying to assimilate George Bush to Adolf Hitler. What I'm suggesting is that Bush, during the campaign and for limited electoral purposes, flirted with those same dark forces which in another land and in very different circumstances brought Adolf Hitler to power. I think that when we see any powerful person start such a flirtation, we have a right and a duty to call on them, by whatever means are available to us, to break it off. For if such a flirtation should ever develop into something more permanent, a dangerous liaison, and the most dangerous of all liaisons, then it might be too late to call a halt to the resurgence of hatred and persecution. I think he's absolutely right.
And right now, everyone in Congress is just jumping on that bandwagon as fast as they can. There is, no one wants to say, this is wrong, because then you're un-American.
It's even more than that. I mean, the current chairman of the Republican National Committee, through his henchman, suggested that the newly elected Speaker of the House was homosexual. This kind of political process is going on, and I don't know how many of you are Republicans. I'm not, clearly. But if I were a Republican, I would write and say, a man like Lee Atwater should not be at the head of my party saying those kinds of things and putting out that kind of garbage.
Lee Atwater orchestrated all that political campaign. We shouldn't be surprised. I mean, he's just doing what he's done in the past. And I vote sometimes Democratic and sometimes Republican. I'm from Minnesota, and I like Dave Durenberger. But I'll tell you, you're absolutely right. People of both parties right now should be standing up on their hind legs and saying, this kind of stuff cannot go on, because it is really dangerous, and it isn't doing just what O'Connor said, flirting with the dark side that we all know exists and can get us into a bunch of trouble, I believe.
Unfortunately, we've got Congress who is flirting with that, as you say, and are not addressing the real issues, and the issues of everything from poverty in this country, economic stability, the big business, assisting families, to the people of the United States. They're not addressing the needs of the people of the United States, but rather they're flirting with this situation of attacking each other and saying what's right and what's wrong morally, rather than addressing our issues.
Yeah. That's what I wanted to get in about. They're even turning the young people on us old people, practically wishing we died.
It's not funny. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to laugh about that, but you're right.
I think it's a small Lee Atwater thing. In this day, anyway, it was neat. There were some quick repercussions. They may not have been strong enough for some people, but he took a lot of heat on that, which I thought was a positive. Something after that crap that he did. He took some heat on that, and maybe not enough, because he's probably still there.
Yeah, he's still there.
Maybe he'll play the guitar.
Yeah, right. let's see. Back to 1920. or before that. I just want to, I'm going to run over this very quickly, because then I want to add the racist element, which is really very, very important in a historical sense. Also, beyond this frayed white collar class and all of the fright and insecurity they were dealing with, there was also within society at that point ideas that we would find today absolutely abhorrent, but were simply accepted by a lot of people. It's interesting that while we talk about Germany in terms of anti-Semitism, it's interesting to note that a lot of these anti-Semitic thinkers or racist thinkers were not Germans. They were British, and they were also French. So it's not just a German phenomenon. It was a European phenomenon at that time. And again, a lot of them never really came out and made the association between their ideas and the Jews. But these racist ideas were then very easily co-opted, and the particular confluence of circumstances in Germany allowed people to make those connections with really deadly results. One person, a Frenchman by the name of Drumont, who lived in France 1844 to 1917, it's interesting to see how these people resembled each other. He's described as a hardworking, respectable, ambitious, but frustrated journalist who believed that his great talents had been blunted and ignored because of, quote, forces beyond his control. Scapegoats, read the Jews. You know, I really wanted to be something great, but it was those Jews that kept me from doing it. I mean, you see the same thing with Hitler, you know, the frustrated artist in Vienna. And those people, these people tend to be very kind of paranoid, self-absorbed kind of people. Read a bit of his writing to you because it's kind of interesting. He wrote a pamphlet in France in 1886, which was reprinted a number of times. It was, at that point, ran to 121 editions, and it was the most widely read book in France. What he did was popularize this ritual murder story among the Jews, in the sense that at Passover, the Jews kill Christian babies to get their blood so that they can use this for their matzah. You all know that one. His main theme, however, was that the Jews not merely crucified Christ in the past, but are continuing to crucify him today in France. He writes, "Christ insulted, torn by thorns, crucified, nothing has changed. In 1800 years, it's the same lie, the same hate, the same people." So here you see it move on a little bit further. This, in a sense, means that the Christian limit doesn't exist anymore. Because what those terrible Jews did in the crucifixion of Christ is still going on now, and there should be no mercy for them because they haven't repented. They're still doing the same thing over and over and over again. Then there were some incredible people, like a fellow named Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who lived 1855 to 1927. He was a British guy, and people actually believed. He wrote things saying King David, the prophets, and Jesus were really Germans. They weren't Jews, because it would be impossible for them to be Jews because of that such great people could not come from anything like the polluted Jewish race. You add to this racist theories, among them the most famous from another Frenchman named Gabinau, who lived 1816 to 1882. He again was a minor official in the French diplomatic service. He was embittered by never having advanced to a post of important service. And in 1853, he wrote a very important book called The Inequality of Human Races, and it was the first systematic presentation of racist general theory. The concept of that book was simply there is one simple cause behind the fall of all civilizations, and that is the dilution of the superior blood in aristocracy by the inferior blood of the common people. So not only was he a racist, I mean, he was elitist as well. He was very undemocratic. The blood of the Aryans has been diluted by the non-Aryan races through democracy, he said. He does not mention the Jews specifically, but again, it was one of those situations where it was easy to make the association at the right time. Then we finally come to Nietzsche, the philosopher Nietzsche, who lived from 1844 to 1900. Nietzsche's philosophy is arguably not anti-Semitic, but again, it was the anti-Semites who grabbed his ideas and ran with them. So that because of this, the philosophy of Nietzsche really became the undergirding of the Nazi state. Nietzsche, in a sense, hated Christianity more than he hated the Jews. He said that the Jews had corrupted Christianity with all of these ethical ideas of compassion. Nietzsche is associated with the idea of the Superman, the Übermensch. Read a little bit of that. Nietzsche's message was that the Christian ethic was poison. Its emphasis on mercy reversed the true Aryan values of fierceness, pride, severity, strength, hatred, and revenge. And the people responsible for this transvaluation of values, the root of all evil, were the Jews. So he says, look at Christianity. Christianity comes from Judaism. There are all these Jewish ethics of compassion, and he hated all those kinds of things. So he said, in a sense, the Jews have polluted Christianity. a quote from one of his books, The Antichrist. "One is among Jews. The first consideration to keep from losing the thread completely, Paul and Christ were little superlative Jews. One would no more associate with the first Christians than one would with Polish Jews. They both do not smell good. Pontius Pilate is the only figure in the New Testament who commands respect. To take a Jewish affair seriously, he does not persuade himself to do that. One Jew more or less, what does it matter?" So again, you see that the Christian limit is abrogated. This kind of idea brings on a person by the name of Alfred Rosenberg, who was a Nazi, and now we're talking about 1930. He wrote The Myth of the 20th Century. And he said that Germany should be rebuilt not on Christian principles, but on the philosophy of Nietzsche, should be a state of supermen, a state without principles. Christianity was a Jewish disease. Forget such Christian principles as guilt, sin, and morality. Instead, there should be devised a new Christianity from which St. Paul has been purged. Jesus was Nordicized, was given a Syrian mother and a Roman father. Both were pure pagans. A new myth was born, the myth of the mystique Bavarian blood, and by and large, unfortunately, the church bought it. And then we moved to the next situation, was where was the church? And the church was with the state. How that happened was rather interesting. Again, I'm going to quote Connor Cruz O'Brien. And he says, he talks about how this could have happened. He said, in the case of Germany, Germany had this tremendous history of ups and downs. And in this sense, Germany is simply, could be a universal. It had gone from great victory over the French to the incredible defeat in World War I. And then you add economic depression and all the other kinds of things, and you have a situation where this kind of thing can take root and flower. The clearest illustration of the power of nationalism in legitimizing the rise to power of the Nazis and then their actions consists of the language and actions of the Christian churches in Germany at that time. Followers of Jesus Christ might perhaps have been expected to manifest some disapproval of the greatest preacher and practitioner of hatred and revenge whoever walked the earth, but the Christian churches, with the exception of a few brave individuals, manifested no disapproval of Hitler and National Socialism. On the contrary, in statement after statement, they hailed Adolf Hitler as the savior of the state. The reason was that the churches were so saturated in German nationalism themselves, as their statement showed, that they were incapable of offering any resistance to National Socialism, which was a particularly militant and therefore particularly impressive manifestation of German nationalism. The infestation, it is nothing less, of German Christianity by German nationalism is most clearly seen in the Lutheran and evangelical churches, who were more German than the German Catholics could allow themselves to be, at least in their doctrinal statements. And he goes on to say that what eventually happened is that the churches simply believed that the German state was an integral part of Christian religion. The two had then come together and were both to be worshipped. He quotes some very famous German theologians, among them Gerhard Kittel, who wrote, "We must not allow ourselves to be crippled because the whole world screams at us of barbarism and a reversion to the past. How the German state regulates its own cultural affairs does not concern anyone else in the world. Justice is not an abstraction, but something which grows out of the blood and soil and history of the state." Paul Althaus, 1888 to 1966, was a German or Lutheran theologian who said, "In this knowledge, we, as believing Christians, thank God, our Father, that he has given to our state in its time of need the Führer with a pious and," he described Hitler as a pious and faithful sovereign, "and that he wants to prepare for us in the National Socialist system a government of good rule, a government with new inner discipline and honor as a creation of God. The state is the law of our life. Well, what happened after that? The Jews were rounded up, they were put in ghettos, they were gassed, and they were burned. That's, I guess, I have the feeling after reading all these things that it was just kind of a natural progression. Somewhere along the way, this was the result. And I think of the famous quote from Martin Niemöller, certainly there was a time along the way when people could have stood up and they could have spoken and they could have stopped it, but at a point there's also, it just takes on a life of its own and it's like a big boulder rolling downhill, and if you get in the way at a certain point, you're going to be squashed. And most of the people who did object to it were squashed. Again, it's a universal lesson here. It's not a particularly German one. But one of the things that most shocked me was when I read that when the Russians started liberating the concentration camps, the extermination camps, they found enough Cyclone B gas. This is the gas that was used to kill the Jews and others to exterminate another 20 million people. It's like the devil was loose in the land. It was, once the Jews were gotten rid of, it's this kind of racist, nationalist mentality. It's not just the Jews, it's anybody else. It's anybody else, it's the Slavs, it's anybody else whose blood is not good enough. So it's really quite amazing. I said before that if there's a lesson to be learned, that is, given the right circumstances, people will believe outrageous things, and on the basis of those beliefs, they will do absolutely monstrous things. Now, any questions before we move on to the Israel section?
Not a question, but a comment that I've encountered in the last year, two former German citizens who are totally convinced that all of that stuff about Hitler is still to be blamed on the Jews. Mm. That it's all a bunch of lies, all this concentration camp stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just plain and simple that every section of a culture is infiltrated with Jews, and they control their own story, mm-hmm. their own propaganda.
Well, that's the totally irrational part of it. There is no rational way that can be explained. I can't find one. Can you? I mean, that's the kind of thing that really frightens me.
Yes.
Really frightens me, because of course there's no reasoning with that. Right. It's just something that's there.
And when you live beside them and with them and work in the same communities with them, how do you converse with that?
I don't know. It's a mystery. That's the real mystery. Okay. Is some criticism of Israel anti-Semitic? I think it definitely is. Some is and some isn't. The fact that some is and some is not, however, should not keep us, I believe, from speaking very clearly what I called before the legitimate criticism of the policies, human rights violations, etc., of the modern state of Israel. That's hard to do, but I think we have to do it anyway. When I talk about some of the criticism is anti-Semitic, I think that a lot of the criticism, like you can say there, that's definitely, we're talking anti-Semitism there. We're talking really irrational anti-Semitism. Just kind of this irrational hatred of groups. It doesn't have to be just Jews. It can be anybody, homosexuals. It can be blacks, you name it. Then there's another type of criticism, which I think is, again, anti-Semitic, and that's a criticism that, considering the political realities in the Middle East today, might put the population of Israel in mortal danger. I mean, we have to look at the political realities of that situation as well. So that kind of criticism I also think is, I don't know if you want to call it anti-Semitic, but it's certainly dangerous, and I don't think Christians should have any part of it. We have to be able to grasp the realities of the political situation that the modern state of Israel is living in as well. And also a kind of criticism which disallows the right of Israel to exist. Now, you can argue from now until next week about whether Zionism was right. We saw yesterday Wali Khalidi saying, well, he didn't believe that the Zionist right overrode the right of the people who were already there. I would agree with him. But now we are faced with a situation as it is. Israel has been in existence since 1948. A majority of the population has been born there. They have no place to go. And there are some very odd kinds of criticisms who say, well, if people who were born up to this period of time should be able to stay, and those people who were born after such and such time should leave. Well, that's just, I think, a moot point now, discussing the pros and cons of the original Zionist idea. Certainly Israel should be criticized for what it does as a state, but to continually sit and talk and argue about whether Zionism itself should have existed or been successful or whatever, at this point I don't believe it's necessary, because the state of Israel is a fact, and it's going to be there. There are kinds of statements which are interpreted by Jews to be anti-Semitic, and I think with good reason. I think any time a Christian wants to make a statement about Israel, about the situation, that we must do it with a great deal of sensitivity. It drives Jews crazy, and I think rightly so, when there is no acknowledgement of their past suffering and the Christian complicity in that. That does not mean that we as Christians have to constantly be on our hands and knees asking for forgiveness, but only that we must speak with a sensitivity about the past that, you know, you and I were not really involved in, but we bear the name Christian, we bear the name Lutheran, and that has certainly something to say about the situation. We have to recognize that past. Especially, it drives me crazy when I hear Christians criticizing Israel by using language of the Second World War period. Who's a Nazi? The Jews are acting like Nazis. The Jews. I mean, do you have any idea how that sounds to a Jew? I mean, I absolutely want to go crazy when I hear Christians using that kind of language to describe the situation right now. Some don't know any better, but certainly some do. I've just read a book by a friend of mine, Rosemary Radford Ruther. I like her very much. But in this book, she talks about the Israeli occupation or the taking of the West Bank in 67 as a blitzkrieg. Now, come on, Rosemary, get with it. It wasn't a blitzkrieg, and to use that kind of language, I think, is totally unacceptable. Whether, in fact, it is anti-Semitic, I can't judge people's motives, but it's how it sounds, and that's part of the sensitivity that I think we as Christians and Lutherans owe to the Jewish people, to not use that kind of language. We in the ELCA just came out with a statement called a Statement of Concern on the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. I and some of the people in the Office of Church and Society drafted this statement, and I like it very much because it begins in this way. The Church Council of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America views the present Israeli-Palestinian conflict with increasing concern and anguish. We are acutely aware of our sinful complicity as Lutherans in the past, especially in the faces of atrocity previously committed against the Jewish people. This confession of prophetic failure in the past cannot lead us to silence now, however. We must speak about the human rights abuses in the occupied territories today, especially amidst the rapidly changing developments in the Middle East. Our faith calls us to stand with all who suffer, whatever their religious conviction or cultural identity. And we go on in the statement to talk about the Palestinian claim, the Israeli claim, what they both want, what their legitimate political goals are, and we uphold those. We understand Israel's need for security, but we also understand the Palestinians' need for self-determination. But I was very adamant that that first section have, again, we don't have to continually apologize, but it just means that we have to have some sensitivity to history that certainly the Lutheran Church was involved in. I think that we have to be sensitive because we have to speak. It's very important. And we have to speak simply because what's going on in the West Bank now is wrong, and there is no justification for it. There's no justification in terms of what Israel calls security. I'm sorry, it is just simply wrong. And there are a lot of courageous Jews who are saying the same things, and the last thing we want to do with our language is to alienate those good people, because right now they need us and we need them. A friend of mine, a colonel in the Israeli army who's become a very good friend in the last three or four years, Mordechai Baron, there was a massacre, well, village of Nahalim, about 6 or 7 weeks ago. The border police went in and killed eight or nine people. And here is a retired colonel in the Israeli army who used to be the chief education officer of the army, who went on his own to that village and stood up in front of those people and said, as an Israeli, as a former officer in that army, he was ashamed. That was in all the newspapers. And it's people like that that we need to support, and we need to support using the kind of language that doesn't alienate them. I think we should stick to the facts when we criticize Israel. We don't need to compare the Israelis to South Africa, because I think that's just intellectual laziness. It's easy to put labels on people, and goodness knows there are enough labels being put on people over there already. Israel is not South Africa, it's Israel. If it has its own kind of brutality, then call it Israeli brutality. It's not South African brutality. Again, that's part of the sensitivity issue, I think. We don't have to use wild rhetoric, because Jews just close their ears to that anyway. It takes courage, I think. And it's takes a little chutzpah, you know, that Yiddish word, a lot of nerve. But I have found myself in the last at least year trying to remind my Jewish friends of who they are. And I mean that they are a people whose ethical tradition came to us through Jesus Christ. And if they lose that ethical tradition, if they lose the prophetic tradition, then we lose it as well. Jews have historically been at the front of civil rights organizations and marches, and that's a great history that we should not forget. And I think at this point in time, certainly our Jewish friends need to be reminded that they have always been a people who have chosen life instead of choosing death. We should be in solidarity with those, especially American Jews. I think a lot of the political possibility of political settlement is going to lay in the hands of the American Jewish community. They are going through a lot of pain right now. That doesn't mean that we don't speak to them and that we don't challenge them, but that they know deep down underneath that we really support them in their criticisms of Israel. And of course, it's much more difficult for them to do that than it is for us. We should criticize, I think, in a spirit of humility, knowing that this is a very complicated situation. It's not simple. Nobody has clean hands in it. There's enough blood to pass around, certainly. So please, no rhetoric, but a lot of compassion. I think we also have to deal with something that's even more difficult, and I'm about ready to deal with it in an article I'm going to write, and that's the misuse of the Holocaust. And now we're getting into a real sensitive area. But it seemed to me, that the Jews are caught, American Jews are caught in a situation where they don't have a theology that serves them right now. They are operating with Holocaust theology, which has painted them as victims. It's hard to see Jews now with their assimilation in the United States and their role here and their life here as victims. It's certainly hard to see that in Israel right now, incredibly powerful military state. The problem, I think, with the Jewish community right now is their theology has not caught up to their reality. They see themselves as victims, and therefore they cannot bring themselves to admit that they are, at this point, making victims of other people. There's a very good book I suggest that you read by a Jewish friend of mine named Mark Ellis. It's published by Orbis, and it's called Toward a Jewish Theology of Liberation. And he makes this argument, saying that what is most needed is that, not that the Jews forget the Holocaust, they'll never forget the Holocaust, no, they should, but that they move themselves out of this this kind of Holocaust theology, because they need something more now to help them deal with the situation at hand. The Holocaust, unfortunately, is also misused by Christians. It's such a terrible thing, and there's so much guilt, and there's so much other things involved with it that we have a tendency to misuse it. I'd like to read a great article in this last issue of Tikkun magazine, which is a kind of left-wing Jewish publication, where this author talks about how the great misuse of the Holocaust is simply that in the middle of political debate, it's invoked. And how can you have any debate when you talk about the Holocaust? I mean, it just cuts off debate. It means that you don't have to discuss the situation as it is, and therefore I see it as a terrible misuse of it and a terrible insult to the victims of that Holocaust to use it as a way of cutting off any reasonable debate about the situation in Israel. Now, at the end of this article, he writes something very good. Sometimes I see the Jewish preoccupation with the Holocaust to the exclusion of all other human disasters as uncharitable, self-absorbed, and self-righteous. On the other hand, it makes no sense to counsel putting it aside for a while. How can we be expected to get over so enormous a tragedy in only 40 or 50 years? It takes time, centuries. It took over 1,000 years for the Jews as a people to get over the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus, and we may not still have recovered from that. My problem is not that the grief is taking too long, but that the orchestration of that grief in the public realm sometimes seems coercive and misguided. Jewish history is filled with disasters, from which some redemptive meaning has ultimately been extracted. The Jews have been very good at that. Whatever disaster befell them, they somehow managed to turn it around and make it seem like redemption. The Holocaust is proving to be a large bone to swallow. It does not turn redeemable so easily. And when we try to hurry up that process with mechanical prescriptions and ersatz rituals, compelling governments and churches to pay verbal tribute to our losses in narrowly defined terms and browbeating our young people to feel more anguishingly the memory of our dead, something false, packaged, and sentimentally aggressive begins to enter the picture. Perhaps the problem is that for many alienated, secularized Jews who experience themselves as inauthentic in 1,000 other ways, the Holocaust has become the last proof of their own authenticity. If so, they should realize that even this proof is perishable stuff. The further one gets away from personal experience, the harder it is to take the spilled blood of history into one's veins. I think that's a great statement, and I'm about ready to write an article based on what he says. It's going to be real tricky, I realize, but I think it has to be said. We're out of time. If anybody has any more questions or whatever, please stay and we can talk about it.
In your gut level, like,